Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, have a listen to this. That was silence there. It's powerful stuff, isn't it? Clinical psychologist Dr. Tony Bates, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
And Tony, people know you as an expert who's been encouraging all of us for decades now to open up and to talk. But today we are going to talk to you about the power of silence. Mm. And this is based on your own personal experience. You've just finished up a 6-month silent retreat in a monastery. So it was Bolton Abbey, it's in County Kildare?
Moon, County Kildare.
And you have a history with them. As a young man, did you nearly become a monk there?
Well, I discovered it like anybody else, I always had a sense there was something more, and I was always looking for that in music and in life and in different ways. But I went to Bolton for some reason and I just felt terribly at home there. It's a small monastery, it has a beautiful small wooden chapel, and I just felt it was a thin place, you know, somewhere I felt a thin place, you know, a sense where you could, you know, those places like hospitals or like in Irish tradition where we meet the sacred, where we can experience something more, that otherness of
that, the divide is thinner.
The divide is thinner. The Moon was certainly, Bolton was certainly that for me. And I was welcomed and I loved going there. I didn't quite understand why, but I just loved it. And they thought I would join. And I, you know, made a very serious attempt to join and did a directed retreat. I was in 1920 and I was all set to go, you know. And the prior at the time said to me, Tony, I think your affectional needs are perhaps too strong for this life. And, you know, 6 grandchildren later, I think I know what he means. But it was... It was true. My path was elsewhere. But, you know, when you get to my age, then you often think about the road you didn't take and what would we like to take that path. And so I wanted to go back there, as I've been going there regularly over the last 50 years, I suppose. But I wanted to go there this time, not to stay in the guest house, which is closed now anyway. That there's a very small community of 3 monks and it's not able to welcome people. But I wanted to go there and live with the community and work with them, pray with them, be with them in silence and just discover what that was like. And it was a 6-month commitment, but truthfully the first 3 months were really tying up loose ends and letting people know I wasn't going to be available. It's quite amazing how it takes time to sort of withdraw, you know, from life.
You had to get your affairs in order.
I had to get my affairs in order to console my children. I wasn't becoming weirdly religious and so on. But May, June, July, I made a very sincere attempt to be quiet and silent.
And their Cistercians, are they at the kind of Trappist end of things? Like it's quite...
Cistercians are Trappists.
They
are Trappist monks.
We would imagine Trappist monks always seems like the very austere, silent kind of types.
Well, Cistercians, it's OCSO, which is Order of the Cistercian Strict Observance. So Bolton is one of those. But of course, it's become much less strict, I suppose, since Vatican II. I mean, people talk to each other now in every Cistercian monastery. But nonetheless, what I discovered is they really, all of them are naturally monks, you know, and they live, even though they're in community, they live quite a deal alone and they live quietly and gently and there isn't much talk. And, you know, that silence, they create that for one another as much as for themselves. Because when you're moving in a place of silence and routine and consistency, you know, you relax. You feel able to be silent within oneself, you know.
So just to set the scene first, explain the rules then. So you do talk. You talk for necessary things, is it? But you
people talk, you know, chat in a very natural way. I got really kind of rigid about not talking, and I explained to the farmhands and the you know the people housekeeper, you know, I explained I'm not going to be talking and I'm not being rude and all this. And I did all this preamble and tried earnestly to be very utterly silent. And then one evening something happened and I needed to speak to the abbot and say, look, I need to talk to you. And it was particularly after Compline when you go into what's called the great silence, the when nobody speaks, you know, after Compline until after Mass the next day. And I had to break that and I apologised. And he said to me, he's a very wise man, and he said, Tony, silence does not mean not talking. And silence, you know, some things we have to say and you say them gently. Silence means not shooting the breeze, not just going on or making a big fuss. So I relaxed and I could talk and I could say things. But for the most part...
So you've mentioned Compline there. Maybe talk us through the day because some people won't know what...
So the rhythm of in the life of a monk, Benedictine or Cistercian, is a rhythm of prayer and work and personal reflection and reading and work, whatever that might be. So it starts in the morning at 4:15. The Cistercians pray seven times a day and the Benedictines four. It's historical reasons.
Lightweights, those Benedictines.
Just not with it, you know. But anyway, the Cistercians start at 4:15 vigils and then it goes to, there are seven offices where you gather and you sing the psalms, you recite scripture and you're in the stalls and that's very beautiful. And it's not too long, but it's frequent. So there's the day is punctuated with these bells that go, and then you head to the church and you take your place in the stall and you get your books and readings in order. And there's a whole, you know, I suppose art form to that, which I got very quickly into, and I could really enjoy it.
See, and it must be pleasant to submit in a way, is it?
When somebody else is holding you, you know, it's like you're held and you just, and there's a simple rhythm and a discipline to the life, and it is, you know what's going to happen next. You don't have to think about it. The bell is going to go and there's going to be vespers and you'll turn up at that place and you'll just be there. I would go to the church myself much earlier in the morning. I get up at 3:15 because I loved the spell before 4:15 vigils. I love the darkness, the silence of the church. That was a very special time, particularly if it was raining on the wooden roof. It's a wooden structure. It was just beautiful. And I found that was the time I could really open myself and be open to the sacred, to whatever that is. We have all kinds of ways of thinking about it, but the experience, I think, is of just being open and feeling alive and feeling connected with oneself, but also the whole world and the planet and the whole thing.
But you see, that sounds very benign now, but I'd say most people are thinking, oh my God, like if the silence went on too long, I would drive myself around the twist. So what started happening for you in the silence? What started emerging?
I think, like anybody else, I kind of drop into silence and I meet a flood of my obsessional concerns and worries and insecurities and predictions and what did he say that for and what should I have said and why didn't I say that? All that noise in my head is there every time I step into silence. And part of what we've really learned through mindfulness is how to let that go, how to drop beneath that, and not by fighting it, but by actually noticing it, but going back to the breath and just centering yourself in your own breath. And silence is really going back to the breath and coming into the present. That's where we find silence. And when I did that, it took time, of course, but I got better at doing that. I got faster at being able to drop beneath the noise. And then you find a kind of emptiness. There's
really?
Nothing there. I mean, you know, it's, but the emptiness is not empty at all. It's really an openness. It's really a peace. It's really that experience of being alive. It's a sense of connection, a sense of wonder. Somebody said once there are four kinds of prayer. There's please, thanks, sorry, and wow. And I think the first three of those, please, thanks, sorry, are kind of talk. You know, they're important. They're very intimate conversation. It's like pillow talk. It's intimate between people who are loving each other and wanting to find each other and connect. But the best form of intimacy, I think, is in silence. And when you get to that, wow. And in that space, you're not thinking, what's going on for me? What? No. You're in the flow of that space. And it's afterwards you think, that was... And it's not always that something. It doesn't always have blinding, flashing lights come, but there's a sense of a cool breeze, a sense of presence, a sense of wonder, a sense of being connected to reality. It's not any kind of mystical journey away from the world, but it is...
And look, I don't want to pick this apart, but I presume you also met Tony Bates there in the silence.
Yeah, that was always the problem. But,
And what did you learn about Tony Bates?
Well, I was thinking about this. You know when people make bread, some people are really good at making bread, and some people's bread turns out beautifully and some people's bread, it's kind of flat. OK, maybe they speeded it up and that. But I think we all kind of have the same ingredients, you know, and we have our past history, we have our current life, our concerns, our limits, failings, things we wish we had done, whatever. But I think monastery is like a proofing chamber. It's like a place where it kneads and molds the elements of our lives together. And then it provides this proofing chamber where the dough is allowed to rise. It's allowed to rise and it's given time. And when you have that time, the bread comes out differently. It's lighter. It's tastier. And I mean, monks are people who are generally lighter and tastier. And I hope by being around them for even a tiny bit of the time they've spent that I am lighter. I've lightened up.
Really?
About
that's
the
opposite to what we might expect. Like you might expect you come out of that very serious and everything. But
I think I'm smiling more and I hope I'm tastier, but that's not for me to be the judge of. But, you know, I do feel, you see, I think when we find a way of being with ourselves that gives us a certain distance, but all, I think, I mean, faith is really an experience of profound love. You know, it's not a set of rules as much as in the experience of profound love that I am okay just as I am in this moment. And when I feel that connection and with that love, then I can be loving to you and I can face things in my life and I can see what's going on for me and there are issues I have to face and deal with, but I can lighten up about them. I don't react as much. Okay. I'm not as pulled by this, that, you know, urge to fix that.
It sounds like you like yourself more since you did this.
I think I do. I mean, and I say that without any ego.
I know, like it's a hard thing to admit, like in Ireland.
I think what changes for all of us as we grow is not all the things we talk about. Why am I doing this and why am I doing that? But if we're lucky, and this is in recovery and mental health, I think we grow stronger in terms of the inner person. And that person begins to feel better about themselves. And lots of the other little things don't disappear, but we can kind of hold them more lightly and we believe in ourselves and that's what makes the difference. And I think it's why we always have to find the person in the patient, because it's that inner person that needs to rediscover their dignity and their self-esteem. And when they find that, you know what? They can face those other things.
Yeah. I keep coming back to the notion, though, of there is some form of submission or letting go here.
There is. There's a huge letting go.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe it's important to say that being in a monastery in Bolton Abbey was a very safe place, a very contained space. And it allowed me to let go.
Yeah.
And it allowed me to open my heart, if you like.
Okay. And we might talk in a minute about how people could maybe do it in their own life.
But some people are in very unsafe spaces where they can't allow themselves to be that vulnerable and where they need to protect against what's happening around them.
Okay.
So
So hang-ups have their place as well, yeah. Were you in contact with your family?
Regularly, yeah, regularly. My son and grandchildren came down to visit me and we had a wonderful day. I phoned Ursula, you know, several times a week, and that was very important to debrief, but also to keep in touch with what was happening for all of them. You know, families, children grow up, but I don't think you cease being a parent. I think I've been more a parent in the last year, actually, than I've been for the previous 50 years or 40 years before that. You know, there's a lot going on for everybody, and people have their challenges and they need support. And yeah, we need to keep in touch. So
and
that
did
was
you
very
keep
important.
In touch with the world? Do they listen to the news or watch
TV? Oh, yes.
TV?
Oh, God, yeah. You know, they do indeed. And you know, sometimes just the headlines and that. But they knew everything that was going on. And we followed the Olympics and the All-Irelands. And, you know, we watched those. It was a TV episode.
But not chatting about them?
Of course, I'd go up and sit with Brother Frank, and we'd watch the TV, and we'd watch all, you know, Cork and Galway. And I'm forgetting who played in the All-Ireland, forgive me. But we watched them and we chatted, and that was great. But I just didn't watch a lot of TV. I mean, we just, our Olympics, we all saw Mona win her bronze medal. And these are real things. I mean, they're very in touch with the world. It's not that they're uninterested with what's happening in the big worldwide bad world. But it was just, there was much less of that, and there was time to read. I brought books I'd had for years that I really wanted to read, but they were kind of hefty. And I brought them with me and I read, and I had time to read slowly and just make notes or, you know, write a journal. I wrote it, you know. So it was a time just to come home to oneself, you know.
Come home to yourself.
Yeah, home.
So could we all do with a bit of silence, yeah?
All of us. You know, I think we all need many things to survive and be healthy, and we need activity, we need food, we need purpose in life, we need things to do, we need support, people, all of those things. But we also need sleep, we need rest, and we need to withdraw sometimes. I think we need to touch into a silent place. That's part of how the body repairs itself, the mind repairs itself. It knits up the ravels of daily care. It connects us back with that, our own centre, and with perhaps love in our life, and it gives us the strength to go back out and deal with stuff.
So I'm hearing it's stillness there as well, stillness and silence.
Stillness and silence.
So like, is it as simple as that in our day, that look, people have all these competing things to do and everything else, but should we prioritise a bit of stillness and silence every day?
Well, I hate telling people what to do, but I think absolutely.
They want to know.
But I think they do. I think all of us need that. We need, and you know, silence is not, I remember the movie Silence, the guy was searching to find a silent place in Ireland, an Irish film, and he was very disappointed that he couldn't find it. And it is hard to find places that are just utterly silent. I mean, that's almost impossible. But I think we're trying to find a silent place within ourselves, within our own hearts. And I think that is possible. And it's possible largely by, you know, going back to the breath. I mean, everybody listening now, all of us here together are different. We have different issues, some very difficult things to face, some with great times they're going through. Different beliefs, different politics, all the rest of it. But there is one thing we all have in common. We all breathe. And if people can just notice that and go back, take a moment to go back to the breath, even three breaths, and come into the present. And if you're driving a car, you can grip the steering wheel and wake up to the present, you know, wake up to what's happening. And I think when we're in the present, the noise dies down a bit. And when we just notice what's going on, smile, don't get uptight, don't get worried about it. But in that moment, say, look, I'll get back to that. But just for now, I'm going to let that go and go back to the breath and just settle. And I think, see what happens, you know, maybe nothing. But sometimes, you know, when you're that open, you're surprised. You know, messages come from nowhere. Thoughts come from fresh perspectives.
Yeah.
And you suddenly think, oh, wow, I can deal with this.
You know, the most powerful tool that I've learned recently is, I'll think about that later.
Yes.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's fantastic.
Not to react. Not to react. To hold and tolerate the tension of not reacting, but just being in that moment and looking at what's happening and saying, you know, what would really help here?
Just on the concept of silence, right? Someone says here, some of us were living like monks during COVID lockdowns. There were huge detrimental effects of that because of that isolation that a lot of people won't recover from. So you chose a silence, and it was, I suppose, what we might call a healthy silence. And then we know that in this country, especially, I suppose, that silence has been this toxic thing. Like, men went silent at a particular point in their lives and was not in a good way.
Yeah.
Marriages went silent. Awful things happened in silences with deafening silences around them.
Yeah.
So silence, we do associate in this country with being a bad thing a lot of the time.
Yeah, we do. You're right. And it has been toxic. But I think real silence is... It's why it's so difficult, because it requires being very vulnerable. It requires facing what's happening in my life with me now, and what do I need to deal with? And it's a confrontation, gentle, but with the truth of what's happening in my life. And so it's to me, silence is as much a call to reflect as it is to deal with my issues, to live in a certain way. But I think faith is that background to silence, that where you draw on kind of a way of living that's gentle and encouraging and loving, and you know, it's about a certain attitude or energy you bring to those issues. I agree completely, Brendan. We not a word, my mother used to say, not a word. And that was, it hid so much suffering and pain. And we become much better at talking about those things. And even men are better at talking to each other. And COVID was difficult, but I don't think the silence was what was difficult in COVID as much as the isolation, the lack of social contact, which is, you know, oxygen for our souls.
Yeah.
And it was, we were just cut off from that, and people really suffered. Also, some people were locked in with other people who were toxic, and they suffered a lack of being able to escape. So they were trapped. So, but I think those were the elements that really hurt us in COVID, and silence itself, I don't think, was the problem.
Someone says here, I did a silent retreat for 3 days once, right? The sense of myself, the sense of perspective and peace I had for a few days afterwards were immense, almost transcendental. You see, it's easy to be transcendental when you're silent, locked away somewhere. But I got sucked back into the day-to-day again quickly, and I lost it all. So tell me about emerging back into the world.
I think... You know, we think about physical health, and we're all for, you know, going on a holiday, having rest and swimming and doing all kinds of healthy things. But I think we recognise now that that's not enough for physical health. You've got to have some kind of practice, some kind of way of looking after yourself physically, and you've got to eat and exercise. You need to do that all the time. You can't just do it for a week, a year, or 3 days.
But and if you have been away there in silence, right, and really a lot of what's been said is necessary, you come back out into the world and then everyone's jabbering on and everything.
I came back on August the 4th. I came back in August, and we had all my children, grandchildren. There was 13 of us in the house at one point. It was like, talk about going from one extreme to another. And I found it very difficult. I found it very disorienting.
Yeah.
And it took me a while. And yes, I would get tired talking, you know, very easily. I just didn't talk that much on a given day. And there is that. But I do think what I'm saying is, I mean, I think, of course, we go on these retreats and they're wonderful. And then we feel demoralized because we lose the taste that we had, the lightness of being that we emerged with. But I think it's why we need to do something all the time. We need some, whether you need to, I think it silence, I think, begins with being able to feel safe and good about ourselves. So the first thing I would say is you need to find people, places, activities that kind of make you feel good about yourself and that make you feel like a good person, that you're loved, that you're fine. And the other thing is we need to find ways of being open, because I think we're actually, the tragedy for me with a lot of human beings is that we're very closed. We have this idea about ourselves and it's like freeze-dried in our brain, and we can't think of ourselves other than being this or that. And we do the same to other people. The moment I can form an impression of you, you're this and that's it, freeze-dried. And I think that's what stifles the spirit. I think we need to remind ourselves every day that I need to be open to being surprised by myself, by other people. And I think finally, I think that when we have problems, it can blind us to the needs of others. And I do think that, I was just thinking, you know, the apostles, John and Paul, but I'm talking about John Lennon and Paul McCartney, but their recipe, the love you take is the love that you make, or the love you take is the love that you make in the end. But what mm-hmm. in the end? And I do think that it's through really caring for others that we find a joy and a peace in ourselves. That so be nourish yourself, be open, and care for others is a great antidote to feeling stale.
Yeah. And I think that answers actually some people texting and saying, is this not all a bit selfish and self-full and all that kind of thing? But it's not. It's clearly made you a better Tony to everyone else in your life as well.
I mean, we all have things to work on in ourselves and we do it so that we can be easier to live with for other people. I mean, ultimately, I think we're doing it for the people we live and work with. We take responsibility for ourselves.
Dr. Tony Bates, always an education. Thank you very much.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.